In 2011, a massive flood hit 7 states, and federal authorities had a plan to let water into Missouri farmland in order to save the southern Illinois town of Cairo. But Missouri officials said Cairo wasn't worth saving. Here's then Speaker of the House, Steve Tilley.
Would you rather have Missouri farmland flooded or Cairo underwater?
Cairo. Have you been to Cairo?
Yes.
Okay, you know what I'm saying then.
Thanks to St. Louis Public Radio for that footage. We'll hear about how that political pressure affected the response to the flood 7 years ago. But first, there's been a surge of openly LGBT candidates running for office across the U.S.
They see the need for more LGBTQ candidates to get involved in the process, but they now see clear evidence that we can win at the very highest levels of government.
That's Anise Parker, president and CEO of the Victory Fund, speaking to Morning Edition. Coming up, the possibility of a rainbow wave in politics and what that would look like here in Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their weekend. Coming up this hour, as we continue to see headlines about floodwaters affecting life and property in the Carolinas, we look back at a flood in southern Illinois in 2011 and what work could have been done to prevent millions of dollars in damage there. But first, across the country, there's been a surge of LGBT candidates running for office. More than 400 candidates running at both the state and local level means it's the most out LGBT candidates ever to run. What's behind this trend? Well, the Human Rights Campaign says that in 2017, more than 120 bills described as anti-LGBT were introduced across 30 different states. Others have noted that this rainbow wave of candidates is also in response to the Trump administration. On the line with me now is Sean Malloy. He's senior political director for the Victory Fund, an organization which works to recruit, train, and elect out LGBT public officials at all levels of government. Also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Jessica Taylor, a political reporter with NPR. Sean, Jessica, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sean, if I can start with you, when we're looking at the numbers, it's about 6 out of 435 lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives identify as LGBT. What would it mean for you and your organization to have more representation? And when we're thinking about all different levels of government, not just the House of Representatives, but at the local level as well.
Yeah, I mean, we have the opportunity this year to almost double the amount of LGBTQ folks in the House of Representatives, as well as in the U.S. Senate. So we're really excited about those candidates, so many of whom are running in targeted seats that Democrats are hoping to pick up in order to take the majority. But overall, we've seen a ton of candidates, both at the federal, state, and local level, step up. And that's hugely important because right now, LGBT people only represent 0.1% of all elected offices in the United States. At the low end, we are at least 4.5% of the population. So we'd have to elect over 22,000 people at all levels of government just to get a baseline level of parity. And so we're excited that so many candidates have stood up this year to help us start to achieve that.
Sean, you mentioned Democrats. Do you help people run for office regardless of what party they're running for?
Yeah, we believe that representation is power, and LGBT electeds, when they're in the room, no matter what the party, what the level of office, they are going to be bringing our community's perspective while at the same time being a fierce advocate for the constituents that they're representing.
Most of them are Democrats. Jessica, I wanted to ask you, especially as we think about people talking about taking back Democratic control of the House, who are some of the candidates you've been keeping an eye on?
So when I was researching a story that I did a few weeks ago on this, I was fascinated by the fact that a lot of these candidates in very targeted races, as Sean mentioned, that are going to be crucial to control of the House are out LGBTQ individuals and ones that could make history. One I talked to, for instance, was Angie Craig in Minnesota. She ran last time, narrowly lost. She's running again. And if she's elected, she would be the first lesbian mother elected. And in Kansas, Charisse Davids. She would not only be the first lesbian, but also the first Native American elected to Congress from Kansas. Gina Ortiz Jones running in Texas, Lauren Bair in Florida, Katie Hill is bisexual running in California. So, you know, this sort of, there are now 23 out LGBTQ individuals that will be on the House ballot now that we've finished the primary season. The last person that won was last week in New Hampshire. Chris Pappas won the nomination in New Hampshire's 1st District, which is a seat that Democrats are trying to keep that President Trump narrowly won. So it's a lot of individuals and in these very important races. And it is a lot of women running as well, which reflects what we've seen, you know, across the spectrum of Democrats running. But I think it just speaks to the diversity of candidates that Democrats have really been able to recruit as well.
Jessica, we've seen a lot of women in office, particularly post as the Me Too movement continues. We've seen lots of women being encouraged, particularly by the Democratic Party. I'm thinking about Representative Sherry Bustos has had her Build the Bench program here in Illinois for a couple of years. Why are we hearing now from LGBTQ candidates saying that they are running? What did folks tell you, Jessica?
I think it is a large part in response to the 2016 election. A lot of people that I talked to said, you know, it was sort of a wake-up call. They, you know, and the Trump administration, some of the things that they've pushed for, such as banning transgender people from serving in the military or these religious freedom bills that they say would endanger and could endanger some of their representation and things. We've seen it at a national level being pushed for, on a state level as well. And so I think that that's pushed a lot of people to run for office. And, you know, I think that just this increasing diversity, as Sean mentioned, there are 6 current LGBTQ lawmakers in the House. 2 of those are running for higher office. So, you know, but there's a lot of opportunity to increase those numbers. And in the Senate, that could double as well. Tammy Baldwin was the first out LGBTQ person ever elected to the Senate. You could in Arizona, you have Kyrsten Sinema, who is bisexual, who is looking for a promotion from the House to the Senate. Both of those have excellent chances of being reelected. And then Kyrsten Sinema is in one of the most competitive races there in the Senate as well.
Sean, do you think this rise in candidates is primarily in response to the Trump administration policies? Jessica's point about the attempt to ban transgender people from the military?
Yeah, I think it's definitely related. Some of our candidates have definitely said that. But I think a lot of our candidates are just tired of politicians squabbling and failing to address the most basic needs. And so many of them, through their experiences, know the diversity of their communities and are stepping up because they want to make real change that benefits people's lives. And we're pretty sure that people are looking for some authentic, values-driven leaders, and our candidates are those folks. We've been saying America needs us because it does.
Sean, as we think about what Jessica was just saying, women in the race, racial, ethnic minorities, Sean, when I'm thinking about people who are candidates, we have there's 4 LGBT candidates running for governor that represent all 4 letters of the acronym. Lupe Valdez in Texas is a lesbian. Representative Jared Polis in Colorado is gay. Incumbent Oregon's Governor Kate Brown was the first open LGBT person to ever win a governor's race. She's bisexual. Christine Hallquist in Vermont is a transgender. But when we think about not just the sexual orientation, but also being a minority, whether they're women or racial backgrounds, what do you think that kind of diversity brings to races?
Well, I mentioned that LGBTQ people are underrepresented in government. Women and racial minorities are also underrepresented. And so, when these folks step up, they don't necessarily just represent the LGBT community. They represent the full diversity of the communities they come from. And so it's a testament to communities wanting to be part of the conversation and be represented.
And we mentioned all of these other places. What does Illinois look like, Sean?
Yeah, we've got a bunch of races in Illinois. We've got a really contested, actually, state house race. Sam Yingling has been under attack. He's a state rep right outside of Chicago. Dick Uihlein lives in Illinois. He's invested a lot of money against him. He seems to fund anti-LGBT causes and to attack LGBT representatives. He was one of the biggest funders of attack ads against Tammy Baldwin up in Wisconsin during the primary and is widely expected to do that again for the general. We've also got an amazing candidate, Kevin Morrison, running for the Cook County Commission. He's running against the chair of the Illinois Republican Party in a suburban district that we feel confident with Kevin's experience and work and investment, we're going to be able to flip. And we've got another candidate who's running for state house as well. Her name is Maggie Trevor, outside of Chicago as well in Cook County. That's, again, another swingy suburban district, so many of these areas that are being targeted by Democrats. And then we've got a few other folks running for judicial offices. And Lamont Robinson was successful. This is down in Chicago. He is pretty unopposed come November, so he's going to be bringing a great voice to Peoria come the general election when he's elected.
That's Sean Malloy, Senior Political Director with the Victory Fund. We've also been speaking to NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor. Sean mentioned Kevin Morrison. We actually have him on the line with us, running for Cook County Board Commissioner in the 15th District. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me now.
So, Kevin, that district would include, so you're running for the Cook County Board Commission. It's Illinois' 15th District, right? That includes the Chicago suburbs of Schaumburg and Hoffman and States. What inspired you to run, Kevin?
What inspired me to run was actually my most previous employment. I was working for our congressman out here in the 8th Congressional District, Roger Krishnamoorthy. And throughout my work with the congressman, I was constantly hearing complaint after complaint about Cook County government and some of the frustrations that our constituents were feeling. And when you have an absent commissioner who is not present in the community and is not representing the voices here on the ground, you know, that was a space that I felt needed to be filled. And without any good individual stepping up to the plate to run, you know, I was happy to take up the mantle. I want to represent the constituents of the 15th district, and I'm happy that I decided to take charge.
And you're running against Tim Schneider, the incumbent, who's also, as Sean mentioned, the chair of the Illinois Republican Party. Is that an intimidating incumbent to be going up against?
I say initially semi-intimidating, but, you know, this is a district that Hillary Clinton won by 20 points. I grew up here. I grew up in Elk Grove Village. You know, the Northwest suburbs are not the conservative suburbs they were once known for. And, you know, I just am going to put my all into this race, as we've been doing since we launched our campaign last November 1st. And, you know, I'm out talking to constituents every single day. And, you know, I feel confident. I'm happy with the message that we're bringing to the doors, and our constituents are definitely feeling it. You know, we have more and more volunteers coming out to the fray every single weekend. We had 14 people with us this past Saturday alone, and we're just going to keep it going all the way through November.
And Kevin, I imagine when you're out campaigning with people, how I wouldn't imagine that even your sexuality would even come up very often, right? Is this something where people, I wonder what most issues are that people are concerned about talking to you about?
You're right. You know, it's something that I'm kind of happy that, you know, this has not been an issue with our campaign. And that's, you know, quite exciting for me as an openly LGBT candidate. But no, the issues that matter are what we're talking about at the doors, be it more affordable healthcare options, be it the inequity in our property tax system. You know, I'm talking to voters consistently about uplifting middle-class families, making sure that especially our younger generations have more opportunities to grow and prosper here in Cook County. And our conversations are fully based on, you know, pushing for more affordable health care and getting better representation and getting elected officials who actually, you know, have face-to-face conversations with their constituents.
We've been speaking with Kevin Morrison, who's running for Cook County Board Commissioner. Sean Malloy is also with us. He's a senior political director with the Victory Fund. Sean, how important is funding in all of these races when we're, as we're talking about just not just the infrastructure, but in case there are people, as you mentioned, putting funds into campaigns, particularly if it's coming down to a party, Democrat versus Republican? How important is the money in all of this?
You know, sadly, it's extremely important. You know, candidates need staff. They need to be able to communicate with voters. They need to be able to run radio ads, commercials, and do mailers to make sure that they're getting their message out there. And obviously that takes resources. And so we work to help get resources to our candidates to help promote them and to harness the power of the LGBTQ community to help our candidates. But what we've seen is that we may not be able to always outspend or raise more than our opponents, but we have a compelling message that's in touch with the needs of constituents. And that's what we encourage our candidates to talk about. And if that message gets out there, you raise enough to do that, our candidates are normally successful.
Jessica, Kevin said that he feels like not necessarily this is his sexuality or orientation has been part of his campaign. Are we seeing that in other races as well? Is this an issue? I guess it depends on the seat.
That is something I heard from a lot of candidates, that really they felt like their sexuality wasn't an issue. I mean, I think that some of them talk about it as just sort of part of their life story as they're talking. You know, some candidates have brought it up in ads, you know, just talking about how I think representation matters, some of the difficulties that they faced in their lives. For instance, Angie Craig, that I mentioned, who's running in Minnesota, she would be the first lesbian mom, but the fact just becoming a mom was a very difficult story. She had a 3-year protracted legal battle to when she was trying to adopt her son. And so speaks to sort of some of the discrimination that LGBTQ people have faced. So they'll talk about that. But I think that, you know, the overarching issues that people are wanting to talk about are healthcare, are the economy, you know, these sort of kitchen table issues. And it's not necessarily a driving force, but I think that it underscores some of the struggles that these candidates have had that make them who they are. And, you know, one thing I've heard from people too, Christine Hallquist, when she spoke with Morning Edition after she won her primary there in Vermont, she's the first transgender person to ever win a major party's nomination for governor. She said, you know, transitioning was the hardest thing that I've ever had to go through. And if I'm governor, you know, I've faced these things. I've been through this. So I think that one thing that I've heard in talking with candidates, they're saying, you know, I've been through struggles. Whether it's coming out or discrimination that they faced or these legal battles, if they're trying to adopt, I think it just sort of underscores their story of, you know, of who they are and what they've had to face to get to where they are.
That's Jessica Taylor, NPR political reporter. I want to thank Sean Malloy with the Victory Fund, Kevin Morrison, who is running for Cook County Board Commissioner in the 15th District against Tim Schneider. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for the 21st comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting the experimental films of Renee Baker on Saturday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. at the Pennsylvania Avenue Residence Hall. Baker will present her films and discuss the creative process in producing these works. More at cas.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been hearing a lot this weekend about tropical weather, hurricanes, and typhoons. At least 50 people died in Hong Kong and the Philippines this past weekend because of a typhoon on that side of the world. And at least 18 deaths here in the U.S. are being blamed on Hurricane Florence, as flooding continues to be a problem in North Carolina. When natural disasters like this happen, they really test the systems that are put in place, whether that's local, state, or federal authorities, to prevent the loss of life or property. In 2011, there was a huge flood here in Illinois. Along the Mississippi River, it flooded 6 other states, including Missouri. And in southern Illinois, the Army Corps of Engineers had a plan to prevent flooding in the town of Cairo. But that plan was delayed by public pressure from officials in Missouri and arguments over which land was worth saving, the Illinois town that was flooding or the Missouri farmland across the river. That delay cost millions of dollars in damage to southern Illinois. We know that because Lisa Song and Patrick Michaels have looked back and into this issue. Lisa is an environment reporter with ProPublica. She's on the line from New York. Patrick Michaels is a reporter with Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. He joins us from their studios just outside of Oakland, California. Lisa, Patrick, good morning. Thank you for being here with us on the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I think before we start, it's so interesting when we think about the history of Cairo. We pronounce it Cairo, but it's spelled like Cairo, Egypt. Of course, it gets its name because the banks of the Mississippi River would overflow and make the crops more fertile, just like the Nile, which is where we get Alexander County's name from. Lisa, what was Cairo like when the plans to protect the area from floods were first drawn up? This was in the early 20th century, right?
Right. So back then in the early 1900s, Cairo was a really prosperous city, had about 15,000 people. The river barge and shipping industry was really big, so it was wealthy. And that is basically one of the reasons why the Army Corps of Engineers decided they wanted to create a contingency plan to try and save this city the next time there was a big flood. And the way they decided to do that was they designated what is called a floodway, which is this big area of land across the river in Missouri. And they basically said, the next time there's a big flood, we will deliberately flood that land in Missouri to save Cairo.
And Patrick, how does this work so we're understanding our terms correctly? At least explain what a floodway is. How does that work with levees? And is the Army Corps of Engineers the kind of the organization that runs all of this?
Yeah, so for a long time in America's history, we had sort of a levees-only policy where the idea was to channel the river into a very precise, narrow corridor. And we found out in 1927 with a huge flood on the Mississippi that swamped a lot of the southern U.S., that was no good because it can make flooding much worse and puts a lot of pressure onto these levees. And so what the Army Corps of Engineers came up with after that was the system of floodways as sort of release valves for that river. And this one on the Missouri side of the river opposite Cairo is the northernmost one of those floodways.
And so that let's fast forward a bit to 2011, right? So we have this floodway and levee system set up, and that was obviously set up at a time when Cairo and the surrounding areas were very prosperous. But as we've talked about the recent history of that, the town was much smaller, much poorer. The floodway areas had actually gotten very valuable. Patrick, with that all in mind, can you describe to us what happened when the 2011 flood hit?
Yeah, so in the decades that followed this plan being created, this farmland in Missouri that had been sort of swampy timberland, you know, the trees were all chopped down. Farmers came in and irrigated it and made it into this really valuable farmland. And they started they began picking up political clout as well. And they, over the decades, made it harder for the Corps, even its written policies, to flood them. This was part of the deal. When a lot of them bought their land, they knew this was going to happen someday, but they sort of, you know, bit by bit leaned on the government to avoid this. When the flood started happening in 2011, the waters were creeping up. They, you know, had meetings with Army Corps officials. Their congresswoman wrote letters. The Missouri Attorney General filed a lawsuit to keep the Corps from blowing up the levee that would flood them. And they sort of marshaled every bit of political clout they could to avoid getting swamped.
And so the idea, Lisa, though, was that this levee would be blown and then that would release the floodwaters into this farmland and save Cairo, right?
Right. So the way the floodway works is there's a giant levee that protects the floodway from flooding along the Mississippi River. And most of the time, this levee is there, and most of the time when the river rises, the floodway is still protected. But when the river rises to a catastrophic, super high stage, at a point where it's so high it would threaten to flood the city of Cairo, then the Army Corps has this contingency plan to literally blow up the levee in front of the floodway and deliberately flood that farmland. And doing that would be an emergency release valve and therefore reduce the pressure on the levees at Cairo to save the city. And what we saw in 2011 was as the waters are rising higher and higher, the people in Cairo were basically trying to shore up their levees, which were crumbling with sandbags. And the mayor basically, you know, went to the press and said, you know, please do this emergency plan for us. He wanted the Army Corps to act quickly. You know, he warned that if the city flooded, it would basically be like another Ninth Ward of New Orleans in Hurricane Katrina.
Right, which is, I think, what most people listening kind of have at least a little bit of knowledge of what a levee is supposed to do because of Katrina in New Orleans. There's some really great pictures of this, by the way, that ProPublica and Reveal have taken with their story. We will tweet that out. We'll have a link at our website as well at 21st Show. But it really explains, you can see very clearly visually where the water was rising and at what level the levee was supposed to have been blown. So there's this plan in place. Lisa, you talked to some residents who said they were sure the Army Corps would not have stalled like this if Cairo had been a wealthy city full of white people. And when you asked the Corps about this, they did not respond to that, that the delay happened because Cairo couldn't bring the same kind of political pressure that Missouri did. I wanted to actually play a little clip from a video that was taken by St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. It's of the Speaker of the Missouri House, Steve Tilley, talking to reporters about the flood response.
Would you rather have Missouri farmland flooded or Cairo underwater?
Cairo. I've been there. Cairo.
If the governor vetoes the...
Have you been to Cairo?
Yes.
Okay, you know what I'm saying then.
Again, that's from St. Louis Public Radio. Lisa, I understand the Speaker of the House later apologized for saying that, but what else do we know about the idea that the delay was in part because Cairo is a very poor place, most predominantly African-American?
Right. So what we know, that these remarks by the then speaker were probably the most famous remarks that came out, kind of stating publicly what some people were thinking at the time. We also know that in a lot of the news stories that happened during the flood, there was sort of this he said, she said mentality, where they were equating, you know, the devastation that would happen if the farmland was flooded with the devastation that would happen if the city of Cairo actually was flooded and people's lives were in danger. So there was this feeling that, you know, putting people's lives at risk was somehow equal to putting farmland and property at risk. And as the flooding was happening, the entire floodway was evacuated. But the city of Cairo, which had about 10 times the number of people as the residents in the floodway, they had a mandatory evacuation, but there were still hundreds of people who remained in the city because they were trying to shore up their levees and prevent their city from flooding. And, you know, this city that had been promised rescue and had been promised they would be safe by the federal government ended up, you know, their levees came very close to collapsing. We know this from subsequent studies that were done. We also know that the Army Corps of Engineers, the man who was ultimately in charge of deciding when to use the floodway, he received several warnings days earlier, telling him, you know, it's time to blow the levee, it's time to make final preparations. And he kept putting it off just a little bit longer every time. And by the time he blew the levee, the river was at 61.7 feet, and, you know, based on Army Corps protocol, it's supposed to happen basically when the river is lower at 61 feet or so.
And Patrick, is it, at what point was, is it just supposed to be at a certain point when the river reaches that height? Is it, I'm not sure if it's, is it 60 feet? Is it 40 feet? Patrick?
You know, it inched up over the years. I think it's 61 was the height that was written into law when the flood happened. But it had actually been lower before that. And, you know, farmers inside the floodway had pressured the Corps and sort of lobbied for this change to happen over the years.
But is it a certain point where it hits this, they're just supposed to blow it? Or how does the decision happen?
Yeah, the initial design was actually that the river would sort of naturally cave in the levee walls when it got to a certain height. And what the Corps discovered was that that wasn't really working with the design they had. And so what they came up with instead was that they would put pipes in the wall of the levee and then pump it full of explosives and then blow it up in a few spots when they needed to.
And
that's all written. It's very specific written.
Right. I would imagine it would be very specific to prevent things like this from happening. Right. But Lisa, what did Major General Michael Walsh, how long did that decision take for him to blow the levee and why did they say it took so long?
Right. So there are all these numbers and procedures written into the Army Corps law that says you're supposed to blow the levee when it reaches 61 feet. But along with that, the Army Corps says there is always some wiggle room and flexibility and discretion. And it ultimately comes down to one person who makes that final decision. And in 2011, it was Major General Walsh. The thing about blowing up the levee is that you can't just flip a switch and blow it whenever you want. There are a series of decisions and preparations you have to make. It takes time to move the explosives to the levee. It takes something like 12 hours to pump the levees full of the explosives. And so a lot of the delays that the major had were about when to move the explosives to the levee and when to start loading the explosives into the levee. So the Army Corps actually published a history report that kind of tells you hour by hour what decisions were made. And it was by reading that report that we got the details of how at various times, starting about 3 to 4 days before the general actually blew up the levee, he was advised at various points, you know, now is the time to start pumping in the explosives. Now is the time to move the explosives to the levee. And during those points, he kept delaying and saying, no, it's not time yet. It's not time yet. And so finally, the levee blew, on May 2nd. He had been warned since several days earlier that it was time to make those final preparations.
And then what happened after the levee was blown?
The water went down very quickly at Cairo, and the city was saved. So the emergency valve did work the way it was supposed to once it was operated.
And Patrick, what kind of damage was there in the meantime to Cairo?
Well, to Cairo, there was damage from the waters creeping up and sort of seeping through the ground, all the while before the levee was blown. And there was levee damage, I believe it's upstream of Cairo. Lisa knows more about that specifically. But the Illinois side got a lot of damage because of those days of delay.
Lisa?
Yeah, so Cairo itself, you know, none of the buildings flooded. Most of the damage to Cairo was in the levee itself. But there were rural communities near Cairo that had weaker levees. And some of those, at least one of those levees did breach, and there was widespread flooding across the county that Cairo is in, because all of those communities would have benefited if the Army Corps had blown up the floodway levee earlier. And so there's a state report that says, you know, millions of dollars in damage could have been avoided if the Corps had activated the floodway even as soon as 1 foot lower, when the river was 1 foot lower or 2 feet lower.
And then what happened to the farmland on the Missouri side? How much was that damaged in the end after the levee was blown and the floodway was flooded?
Yeah, there was a fair bit of damage. I mean, you know, when the levee is blown, it, the material in the levee kind of spreads out across the farmland there. But it actually recovered pretty quickly. There was, a lot of the farmers were able to harvest a crop later that year. The land was underwater for a couple weeks in a lot of places. But for the most part, the farmers, they had insurance claims. They recovered a lot of what they'd lost. The ironic thing that we kind of get to at the end of our story is that there's a town called Pinhook that was right in the middle of the floodway, and it was founded in the 40s. By black sharecroppers who weren't able to buy land anywhere else. So they sort of got this doomed land in the floodway. That was the place that they built their town. And from what I've heard from them, they didn't really have much of a seat at the table in all of these negotiations the farmers were having with the Corps and these meetings that we're talking about. They were sort of left in the dark. And, from their perspective, this all happened very quickly. And now their town is completely destroyed.
Hmm. I wonder, as we think about this was 7 years ago, what lessons you think there is now, especially as we think about this hurricane season, the flooding that we're seeing in different parts of the country. Lisa?
Well, I think one thing to think about is that there's a difference sometimes between doing the best thing because it's scientifically correct and how to actually implement that with policy. So when you're thinking about what happened in 2011, the idea of designating floodways is something that makes sense scientifically. But the Army Corps, after it designated the floodway in Missouri, allowed people to continue living and farming there, and then once it was time to use the contingency plan, kept delaying. So I think there's often a difference between having a plan in place and then actually using it in the correct way so that it does what you want it to do. And, you know, what's happening now with the Carolinas, there are far fewer levees in North and South Carolina than there are along the Mississippi River in the Midwest. So it's more of a different situation there.
We have to take a break. If you guys can stick around for a minute, Patrick, I'd love after the end of the break for you to answer as well what Lisa just did. As we're listening to the 21st, we're speaking with Patrick Michaels. He's a reporter with Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting in Oakland. Lisa Song's been on the line with us from New York, where she's an environmental reporter for ProPublica. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st, and we'll pick up this conversation just on the other side of this short break.
Support for the 21st comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting video, sound, and sculpture by Irish artists Gareth Kennedy and Sarah Brown in the exhibition Kennedy Brown, The Special Relationship, opening October 4th at 5:30 p.m. More at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Lisa Song. She's an environment reporter with ProPublica in New York. Patrick Michaels is also on the line with us from Emeryville, from the studios of Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. We've been talking about their work, their investigation into the 2011 floods in Cairo, and talking about the plan that was in place, what they have learned, this pressure that we've talking about between the farmland in Missouri, the towns on this side of the border and the river. Patrick, I just wanted to wrap up, especially as we're thinking about those communities in Missouri, those towns that did end up getting destroyed. I wonder what you think lessons we should be thinking about for the future.
Yeah, I think that the top level takeaway from me from this story and from a lot of our project, this is an ongoing project of ours, looking at these issues nationwide. You know, you're always going to have one side of the river against the other when it comes down to something like flooding, because everyone's sort of trying to do all that they can to save their homes. And with the federal government comes in, they're supposed to be the arbiter of disputes like that. And they talk about science, and they talk about the cost-benefit analyses and these sort of like cold, hard terms that sound like it's very scientific and supposed to take the politics out of these decisions. But what we've seen is a lot of times that kind of language can mask the real kind of values decisions that are taking place and deciding who gets flooded and who manages to weather a flood okay. So Cairo was damaged because of the delays. The farmland did get flooded, but they recovered, but the town in the middle of the floodway didn't, and it was all had to do with different decisions along the way that the federal government had made. A lot of times when we're talking about flood policy, I think it's important to sort of look beyond the scientific language and sort of the cost-benefit analysis language and really understand who's being set up to win and lose in these situations.
To that point, coming up on tomorrow's program, it's been a year, actually, since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, where 3,000 Americans died in the aftermath of that storm. We're going to be hearing from Illinois residents who were affected by the hurricane, including one man who had to leave Puerto Rico for Chicago. We're also going to get some updates from folks at NPR who've been covering what's needed on the island. Right now, I want to thank Lisa Song with ProPublica, Patrick Michaels with Reveal for being with us to talk about Cairo in 2011. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's that time of year when most monarch butterflies start their 3,000-mile migration from the northern parts of our continent, whether that's Canada or the northeastern United States, to Southern California, Mexico, and Florida to get away from the cold. Maybe you've planted milkweed or helped tag monarchs to track that migration, but they're still in trouble. Their population has been decreasing since 2008. It's down 90% in the last 20 or so years. What is Illinois doing about that? We are going to talk about that now with Greg Spirius. He's a research scientist at the Illinois Natural History Survey. He's with me here in our Urbana studios. On the line, we have Lindsay Ramsey, who's the Associate Director of Natural and Environmental Resources with the Illinois Farm Bureau. Greg, Lindsay, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Greg, can I start with you? And can you just explain, this is kind of a, it's a really amazing migration that happens. I was looking at maps before the show of the patterns, and the monarch butterflies don't just go across our part of the country, but they go across the East Coast as well. Can you just explain their different paths and patterns of where that traditional migration has happened?
Sure. There's a giant range where monarch butterflies live across eastern North America. So east of the Rocky Mountains, up into Quebec and Canada and Montreal. And then as the summer progresses, they sort of live and breed and build up their numbers. And then they all funnel down during right now, basically this time of the year, down through Oklahoma, the Gulf Coast, down through Texas, and then down to Mexico for their wintering grounds.
And that happens every year?
Every single year. The amazing part about it is that it's not like bird populations that migrate that way, where you always have some older birds who kind of know where to go and know how to get there, and so know how to navigate. With monarch butterflies, you're talking about the great-grandmothers and great-great-grandfathers are the ones that end up every year coming back and forth. So they've never been there before. They have no, you know, it's all a genetic sort of imprinting on how to get back and forth.
It's remarkable. So it's their genetic imprinting that allows them to know which way to go, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And when we look at, do we know why the population has decreased so dramatically in the past 20 years, Greg?
That's the million-dollar question. Bunch of different ideas and hypotheses and that are receiving a lot of research right now.
What theories are out there?
For we can sort of go through the sequence where people started first noticing the declines was initially like the wintering grounds in these forests, high elevation forests in Mexico, were sort of being cut down and being cleared and were shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And then there were some protections put in to protect those areas, but they kept declining. There's still some thinking that the harming of those forests is harming the populations that end up here. But then you started to get into some sort of heavy pesticide farming practices that potentially eliminated a lot of their larval food sources, the little caterpillars, the milkweeds that they rely upon have really been largely lost from our croplands. And so that was thinking that was the silver bullet. There's some research that's come out over the last couple of years that suggests, well, that's part of the answer, but it's really not the whole cause. You know, some of the bigger ideas now are it's just, you know, a combination of perhaps pesticide loads. It's a combination of loss of habitats for them nectaring along their migration route, in addition to the milkweeds that have been knocked back.
That's Greg Spirius. He's a research scientist with the Illinois Natural History Survey. Lindsay Ramsey is also with us with the Illinois Farm Bureau. Lindsay, to Greg's point about milkweed, what had milkweed been, what had that looked like in Illinois in the past in terms of where that was planted?
Yeah, great question. So I always, when we start to talk about the monarch butterfly, talk about it that, you know, monarch butterflies are quite a unifying symbol. We all grow up, you know, we grow the caterpillars in our third grade classroom or our parents bring them in over the summer. We all know what the monarch butterfly is. It's very unifying across the country. Milkweed is not, you know, milkweed is not a unifying symbol. And I say that because our farmer members here in the state, many of them, frankly, grew up pulling milkweed by hand because it was a weed, it was a pest in their crop fields. And so there's an interesting relationship there with milkweed. And it did used to grow in crop ground as well as road ditches and in more natural areas. So what we've seen is a little bit of a shift. And I think some of Greg's research actually points to the fact that maybe the milkweed hasn't declined quite as much as folks thought, because it's actually going very well in other places. So we do see milkweed on the roadsides. There's been lots of efforts lately to increase those populations of milkweed so that we can provide that necessary food source for the monarch caterpillar.
What does the milkweed look like for people who haven't seen, Lindsay?
You've probably seen it, whether you knew it was milkweed or not. I believe there's upwards of a couple dozen different varieties of milkweed. I'm not sure how many are native to Illinois, but there's probably 10 or so different types of milkweed that can be found here in Illinois in different parts of Illinois. They grow in different soils and different precipitation patterns and climates. You can see them on the highway, a lot of common milkweed right now with the big leaves, the sort of the singular stem. You can also see really vibrant butterfly milkweed, which is a bright orange color. So there's a lot of different kinds.
And Greg, it is a weed.
Weed is a term that is unfortunate. It's probably a holdover from, you know, England, when every plant was called a weed. And so there's some people who want to create a campaign to start
to change the name milkweed.
Right. It's a butterfly plant or something like that. One species, the common milkweed that Lindsay mentioned, will grow pretty problematically in crop fields. The rest of them are fairly, kind of diminutive and sort of stay in place and sort of grow in the native habitats and native ecosystems where they're supposed to grow.
So it's not a weed in the sense of we think it's just kind of growing everywhere and growing out of control.
The common milkweed can get a little bit exuberant, I guess I would say. It's sort of an in-betweener, I would say. It's not a full-on scary weed, but it can be aggressive in places.
And Greg, why is the milkweed important for the monarch butterfly?
It's the only plant that their larva can eat. And, you know, for those of you who don't remember this lesson from grade school, potentially, it's very special in that it contains toxic chemicals that many, many things cannot handle. And when the caterpillar eats it, it's sequestered it in its body, and it gives both the larval caterpillar and the adult a certain level of protection from predation. Things that take a bite of it, they don't want any part of it because it tastes disgusting. And that's why, probably part of why, the adults are colored so vibrantly, because they're advertising, you know, I am toxic because I ate a milkweed plant, and you're gonna regret eating me.
Lindsay, what efforts are the Farm Bureau making to help with? I know that there's lots of different efforts. I know schools, elementary schools do projects where they plant milkweed. What is the Illinois Farm Bureau doing to try to promote this as well?
Yeah, so we've been actually involved in pollinator efforts more broadly for years now, and more specifically on the monarch for the last 2 years. There's a statewide planning effort going on, which is deemed the Illinois Monarch Project, and that's actually celebrating its 2-year anniversary this month. And that involves all folks from all across Illinois. So we've got urban areas, natural lands managers, rights of way managers, and then agriculture, as well as different scientists from the universities in our state, to kind of collectively think about how do we conserve monarchs into the future. And so Illinois Farm Bureau has been at the table leading some of the ag groups in that effort, thinking about what can farmers do, what can other ag constituents do in the state, north to south, east to west in our state, to make an impact on the monarch butterfly.
Greg, Lindsay mentioned pollinators. I think lots of people are aware of the role that bees play, a very important one. Monarch butterflies are certainly beautiful. They're not necessarily pollinators, right? So I wonder, for people thinking, why do we care about their conservation, the conservation effort of monarch butterflies?
They're gorgeous. They're the state, I think they're the state insects. It's really an aesthetic thing. You know, do we want to have beautiful things around us? We've eliminated so much of our native flora and fauna and so many of the beautiful things that, you know, feel like America. And this is one thing that, you know, Lindsay was mentioning all the different groups and civic organizations and schools, and people get excited about them because they're just gorgeous. And they give us an indication of, like, oh, this is our land and this is our flora and fauna, and it's gorgeous.
It is the state insect. Do you feel confident about the future of monarch butterflies and their populations?
You know what I feel confident is how many people are paying attention. And, historically saw some of these large charismatic animals and went extinct in our part of the world because people kind of weren't paying attention and didn't really care until it was too late. And now I have never seen an effort behind a species like an insect, nonetheless, around a species like this. So people are paying attention. Politicians are paying attention. You know, school children, neighbors, everybody. It's really great to see. I will always have monarchs. It's a question of will we have a lot of them that we will see in our part of the world and say, wow, look at the monarchs this year. It's fantastic.
And Greg, for people who are listening who maybe this is the first time they're hearing about it, what do you want them to do?
Habitat. You know, even in your yard at home, plant indigenous native plants. They will give you the best bang for their buck for the birds and the bees and butterflies. It's all about habitat. And, you know, you don't have to treat your lawn like a golf course. You don't need to dump all kinds of chemicals on it. Leave some of the dandelions in there. Leave some of the clover in there. Habitat.
That's Greg Spirius. He's a research scientist with the Illinois Natural History Survey. I want to thank Lindsay Ramsey for being with us as well. She's the Associate Director of Natural and Environmental Resources for the Illinois Farm Bureau. Lindsay, Greg, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Great to be
thank
here.
Thank you.
If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. You can always find past shows that way. It's pretty simple to download it. Then you can set your home station for wherever you're listening. And then if you search for the 21st to follow us, just use that magnifying glass. That's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. All those links, every other way to contact us, all you have to remember is our website, which is a great resource, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day.